was talking simultaneously to George. Do you have a suggestion?
Yeah, sorry, that was probably me. This is KC2SHO John in Los Alamos. You know, I've, in the past I had a mobile phone screen repair company, and I still do it on the side. But for some reason I'm leaning towards the LCD. That, perhaps, something's happening within that LCD itself. But that's just a guess. And I'm really not sure why, so I don't have much more than that. Back to you.
I've got another guess, sir. NWS2M, put me on the list. Very good. I'm glad to hear it's engaging people. It's not totally the LCD. If it was just the LCD, one would assume that you wouldn't get a display, but you could get sound and you could find some degree of life in the device. It was just basically bricked for a couple of weeks. Dick, what's your comment?
2J Alpha. You can only get a 3 Tesla or 1.5 Tesla machine magnet to stay that strong if it's got a superconducting magnetic coil running in liquid helium. The liquid helium keeps that temperature by continuously boiling off. So therefore there's a low level of helium in that room. Helium is an extremely strong small molecule. It can get into anything. And if it gets into those microcircuits, there are a number of microcircuits, particularly the one that can tell when you've tilted it from horizontal to vertical. It's got vibrating reeds inside, and so you change the density of the gas that's in there, a little bit of helium instead of ordinary air. That reed runs at a different rate, and I bet you the electronic says, bunk, I don't know what to do with that. That's a guess. The liquid helium, the helium gas, low level, nowhere near high enough to give any grief to the human beings, but the electronics cannot tolerate that. Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
What precise answer?
What was that, Eric?
Kind of more precise answer. We're all familiar with oscillators, and we normally think of an oscillator as a crystal. Well, if you think about how thin an iPhone and Android phones are, they don't use crystal oscillators as their frequency reference anymore. They use MEM devices. And the helium actually gets absorbed. The molecule is small enough to make its way in through the port, actually in the MEMS devices that allow a little bit of the outside world in, and it takes a long time for those molecules to dissipate. And when they finally dissipate, the oscillator will oscillate.
Let me just ask Paul what his was planned to be.
Yeah, boy, I'm going to go with something scrambling the CPU, something in that that's particular to the iPhone, and I think it's coming from the MRI machine. When that magnetic field shuts down, it creates an electrical field, you know, like an antenna. So you have, you know, the electrical and, you know, the EM field, so even if it shuts down once or a number of times, I know when you go through those things, you know, you can hear them going on and off. Must be creating an electrical field at some point. And maybe it's frying something inside a memory or something inside the phone, erasing something. Eventually, you could probably get it back. I'm thinking, you said it does come back. But I'm going with the possible EM field. Back you are.
Okay. Paul, it's an excellent answer. It's probably the go-to answer that I would have first thought of, but basically Eric had it on the nose. Quartz crystals are all over the place. They can be very small, but they're not small enough for Apple, apparently. They wanted something smaller and even more efficient. So enter the electromechanical system. It's a microscopic device with moving parts. MEMS are usually made up of components that run anywhere from 100 to 1 micrometer in size. They use silicon, they use polymer, they use metals, they use ceramic parts. And often they use the same fabrication technology that's used to manufacture the intricate solid-state electronic components that we have. They've been around for a few decades. Anyone who's owned a digital light processor, rear projection TV, as I did in the late 90s, early 21st century, had an array of Micromira MEMS as the display engine for the television. MEMS have been with us many different components. A while ago on the TechNet, if you recall, we were talking about accelerometers and gyroscopes and compasses. Now, all those are MEM devices. They're used in inkjet printers, they're used in microphones, they're used in pressure sensors, they're used as optical switches, they're used in biological labs on a chip, and even fine motor devices. Let me drop for a sec. Nowadays, they're even used in new wristwatch movement designs. But there's one thing that MEMS appear to excel at, and that's as very small, very efficient, very precise time-based oscillators, as Eric mentioned. Apple's included them in the design of many recent iPhones. So the simplest way that I can explain a MEMS oscillator is that they're like pure silicon tuning forks. They're fixed at one point, and they're let to hang free at the others, and electrostatic forces cause them to oscillate at resonant frequencies, and you can design the dimensions to be resonant at different frequencies. But why do we have a problem with MRI machines? Well, as Dick mentioned, MRI machines vent helium, and helium gets into everything. And unfortunately, helium also gets into silicon metal, which is what these tuning forks are made of, and it changes the characteristics. So what happens, and you can reproduce it, and there's a YouTube that I'll give a link to, is as you expose it to helium gas, the frequency of the oscillator starts to go up slowly, and then rises, and then crashes down. And what you've effectively done is you've lost your local oscillator, your time-based oscillator, for your entire cell phone until the helium is able to diffuse out of the MEM device. Let me drop for a sec. Now, as I mentioned, it takes a couple of weeks for that to happen because diffusion is very, very slow. But once it diffuses out, the MEM oscillator oscillates at the relatively right frequency and all's well with the world. You can make it impervious to helium. You can hermetically seal a MEMS device, and they still work. The problem is that they're much larger if you do that than if you don't. And that's why Apple tried to get away with something, and they just put a sticker on the side, say, by the way, don't take this into an environment that has a lot of helium on it. But the manufacturer of that particular part has kind of declared that they're going to work on making it more impervious to helium. Dick already kind of gave it away, but what percentage of helium in the air do you think causes this catastrophic iPhone failure?
How about 0.1%?
That would be incredibly fascinating. Fortunately, it's not quite that fascinating. It's not a lot, which is why no one really noticed, no one really cared. All it takes is somewhere between 1% and 2% partial pressure of helium in an environment, and your MEM oscillators are gone until they get diffused out. Yes, Rich.
First of all, another subject, then we'll get to the subject. I couldn't get in there earlier. My desk mic got covered in water in the building. Anyway, what I did was I dunked the base of the mic in water to clean out the building. And then I used the heat gun. Everything is now working. Now, what I want to talk about is surgery on my son. Patty came up to the hospital with a group of my friends, and we were sitting in a room pre-surgical. And he lit a candle. Patty is very religious, so she lit a candle and prayed. And the gal came running in there and said, put out the oxygen tanks, she pointed to them. The sealed oxygen tanks, why are they dangerous?
Okay, Rich, a little off topic, but what the hell? if the tanks are perfectly sealed, is anything perfect, they're not dangerous. If there's a leak in the oxygen, as we kind of discussed with last week, unfortunately, the English language is very problematic. Oxygen is not, by definition, flammable, because flammable means it burns in oxygen, and oxygen doesn't burn in oxygen. But oxygen is very important for anything that burns. You put more than the 20% partial pressure of oxygen in the atmosphere in your environment, and everything burns much faster, and you make 100% oxygen, and the damn things can explode. So I think it's more of a risk of both oxygen leak and, more important, oxygen use. Oxygen's used all over the hospital environment, and if people start lighting flames, you're going to start fires all over the place.
Okay. Well, it seemed innocuous to me when I got out of surgery, because there were a bunch of tanks. I don't know if they were leaking oxygen. Anyway, that's what I was wondering. Take the next question. And to Leo. I couldn't get in there earlier because the mic trouble started to work, so I got in here.
With 1 or 2% helium, if a person had perfect pitch in their hearing, I wonder if they would hear a slight change in the pitch of people who they know very well when they're talking. Okay, Roy, K2IW.
That would be a great little trick to see how good a person's pitch recognition is, because that would be a really small fluctuation. But that would be fascinating to find out if anyone had actually ever tried that.
WS2N?
Yes, Paul.
I don't have an iPhone, but if I did, would I have to be worried going to a party and you got all these balloons all over and the kids start popping them and, you know, they're all filled with helium? You know, what's the chance of my phone getting fried? Or temporarily fried? You said eventually you'd make a comeback.
Yeah, I mean, theoretically, I think it would require a heck of a lot of balloons and a very, very airtight environment. You have to realize that even nowadays, houses and all kinds of rooms are very leaky. So I would be incredibly amazed that that you could pop a reasonable, affordable amount of helium balloons and get it up to 1 to 2% of the entire partial pressure air in that room. So I don't think you have to worry about it. If you have a tank of helium in the side hissing at you, then you probably should take your iPhone someplace else.
I think it takes a combination of the 1 or 2% and a lot of time. Weren't those iPhones in that environment for a week or two before the effect set in, Roy?
Well, yeah, to a degree it was a gradual onset, and the failure was just a cascade failure. I don't think the phones were just sitting there steady state for weeks. People who kind of took it in, walked around some more, and slowly it diffused in. So, yeah, it's also amount of time. And whereas the helium balloons would kind of bust and then slowly the helium would go away, you had all these people in the MRI facility that had the helium that just kept on leaking into the environment. So it was a kind of a steady state 1 to 2% helium atmosphere for a protracted period of time. According to the report, it took a few weeks after the MRI was installed that the failures were noted. But they, you know, they don't give exact numbers of how long each of the phones were in the environment before they failed.
If they ever discharge a MRI machine, in other words, they're going to bring it down to room temperature, they're going to be dumping a whole lot of helium. I'd like to believe they either go through a procedure that reclaims that helium, or they vent it outdoors with a pipe. If they vented it into the room, potentially I think that's that could create anoxia, couldn't it, Roy? Go ahead.
Well, I don't think they mean to vent significant quantities, and 1 or 2% is very innocuous. Again, the partial percentage of oxygen in our atmosphere is 20%. The other 80% mostly is nitrogen, and there's a little bit of argon in there as well. So you could put 10% helium into a room and not have any problem except for your high voice. So it's probably not a problem, although it's an economic problem. If they have significant loss of helium, it's probably cost-effective to have some kind of storage device that traps it above, you know, higher levels, because it floats up to be collected and then re-liquefied. Yes, Eric.
I just thought I'd bring up the small gas molecule thing. Was it one of the transmitters that I had has a thyrotron in it, and it's filled with deuterium. And you have to replace it about every fourth year, because the deuterium actually finds its way out of the tube, and the tube is made out of 8-inch thick ceramics. So it gives you a little idea of the migration power of small things. And by the way, in terms of recycling in world trade, all the stuff is pressurized with nitrogen, and helium is used for some things, and it's all a closed system, so they have a simple way of recycling it.
Okay, I mean, that's very cost effective, and helium is only going to get more expensive because more and more people are using it, and resources are dwindling, unfortunately. But yeah, helium is one of those things. It permeates through a lot of material that we assume are solid, but it's a very small atom, and it just rides right through it. The surprising thing to me, at least, is there are some guys who did experiments. Again, I have a YouTube link that I will post, where they tried hydrogen. And you would sort of think that hydrogen would be the same problem. Hydrogen is even smaller than helium. It must cause more havoc for the MEMS device. But apparently he tried helium, and it didn't have much of an effect. So it seems to be some kind of interesting interaction of diffused helium into the silicon matrix crystalline structure that just kind of totally destroys its inherent resonance qualities. So I found that somewhat fascinating as well.
Is it possible the helium molecule is smaller than a hydrogen molecule?
Well, hydrogen are molecules because they have a valence shell, and so it's H2. Helium is an atom. Helium is a neutral a noble gas that doesn't combine with almost anything. So it's possible that the hydrogen molecule is bigger than the helium atom. The hydrogen atom by itself would have been smaller, but that might be part of the reason why helium per se has a more destructive effect.
Say the helium changes the velocity factor?
Helium has two protons in the center. It's got a stronger magnetic, it's got a stronger electrostatic field. Therefore, the electrons going around it are packed in tighter. So for two reasons, I think helium is a smaller molecule. It's a smaller atom. A helium atom and a hydrogen atom, I think a helium atom is smaller. And the hydrogen, because it's H2, again is bigger. So for two reasons, I think helium is a smaller object. Therefore, when they do a hermeticity test, you can have something that is a hermetically sealed chunk of electronics, where it's in a metal can, where the cover in the can is welded tight. And they literally put it into a high-pressure helium atmosphere, knowing a certain amount will diffuse in. Then they put it into a detecting machine and count every helium molecule one at a time coming back out to measure the hermeticity. Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
Okay, I mean, it makes sense. I don't think the size factors are that dramatic, as opposed to atomic helium and atomic hydrogen. I think the big factor is the atomic structure of molecular hydrogen. And I don't know exactly what it is that Apparently, the helium diffuses directly into the silicon, the matrix of the metalloid. Silicon is not a metal. It's not a non-metal. It's something in between that allows us to use it as a semiconductor. So they call it a metalloid or metal-like structure. And so it has a crystalline structure and certain qualities of flexibility and resonance and such. And I think when helium atoms are intercalated into the matrix of the silicon, it changes the quality of the flexibility of the material and distorts the resonance of the given mass and geometry of the tuning fork that's designed in the MEM. I mean, the entire subject of these microelectronic mechanical devices are sort of fascinating. As I said before, you name it, and they've been doing things with it. They're building new watch movements with it. You can build a motor, a micro motor based on MEMS. I had a rear projection television made out of MEMS. So it's one of those great technologies that doesn't get a lot of airtime. People don't really talk about it. They don't really think about it. It's just there. Anyone with any other comments, questions, or answers about microelectromechanical devices, or I'll move on to the next story. Okay, let's see. Mars is lacking in the vast supply of natural resources that we've come to rely on here on Earth. And astronauts attempting to colonize or even just visit the red planet can bring a limited supply of materials with them. Learning to make do with what Mars has to offer is one of the biggest challenges of visiting our nearest neighbor. But the results of the European Space Agency's latest 3D printing experiment prove it isn't impossible. We've sent probes and rovers to Mars, but to date, it's only been a one-way trip. Our knowledge of what Mars is made of comes from a limited source of spirit and opportunity. And to learn what the sample, to learn from samples and studying Martian meteorites that have made their way to Earth. Like our moon, if there's one thing Mars isn't lacking, it's dust. So, as a stand-in for genuine Mars ingredients, researchers have turned to simulated versions of lunar soil, also known as lunar regoliths. Working with an Australian company called Lithos, the European Space Agency 3D printed a sample of various parts using a light-sensitive binding agent mixed with regolith, which itself is made of silicon, aluminum, calcium, and iron oxides that have been ground to a very fine dust. Instead of heating the mixture, extruding it like hot glue and then letting it cool and harden, the 3D printing technique used here instead lays down very thin layers of the regolith, which are exposed to light, causing the binding agents to solidify. Let me drop for a second. The parts are then baked in an oven to create a solid ceramic material, which is not only strong, but also features a smooth, uniform surface texture, so that they're compatible with machine parts that have been created with high precision. If you've ever seen a 3D printed object made from melted plastic, the obvious imperfections on its surface are easy to spot and problematic for the use in precision machinery. The European Space Agency's next step is to thoroughly test the strength and durability of these 3D printed parts in order to determine if they can stand up to the rigors of space travel and life in a harsh environment. Eventually, instead of pulling a trailer full of spare parts, a manned mission to Mars could simply have to bring along a digital archive of all the parts used in the ship and other structures, a 3D printer, and maybe a bucket for collecting some local soil. I've decided to treat myself to a little 3D printer of my very own, but I guess that the stuff that I print will likely be more terrestrial in nature. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I touched on this very little last week about the regenerating machine that they sent up to the ISS on the Cygnus space cargo vehicle that's now attached to the space station. They take these machines out of the Cygnus, and they attach it to one of the science racks, and it's going to take some of the prefabricated wrenches and things that they made from other 3D. It was a 3D machine, so they took some of those. They're going to take some of those products and put it into this regenerating machine. It's going to melt it down, and it's going to create essentially malted. I'm going to call it ink, but it's going to create reusable ink, so they'll be able to take that and make different machine parts with different tools over and over again. So you combine that with the regolith that they could get from the moon, and they might really be onto something. You go onto a deep space mission, and you're not going to be able to get the stuff from Earth. And you'll be able to, make wrenches, make gears, different covers. And then when they don't need them anymore, they can melt them down in this regenerating that they just sent up. And then they can put that material back into the printer and, make something new over and over again. So, they could be on their way. I mean, not only can they use the resources of the moon, but then they could reuse those resources of the moon if this regenerating machine works.
Well, yes, Paul, I would agree. Although probably when it comes to things like moon dust, there's probably a lot of it there, so they don't have to quite worry that much about recycling. 3D printing is another really interesting subject that I'm just starting to get into. There are different technologies and there are different materials being used. Most hobbyists tend to use some form of plastics, which are thermoplastics. You heat them up, they melt. You could reform them into filaments, and you can rebuild them into anything 3D that you want. There are other technologies that use polymers that are activated by laser interactions, and there are others that use sintered metallic powder that have a binding agent that binds usually through something 3D. So there's a lot of different technologies that are all kind of designed to do this, and it's sort of reminiscent of the Star Trek replicator, although the replicators could give you a cup of coffee, and 3D printers can't quite do that. They can machine relatively simple parts. If you have a little gear that you need replaced, if you have a battery cover on a remote control and you know what it's supposed to look like, you might be able to fashion a new one. It's another little fascinating subject that I've decided to look further into. I bought myself a 3D printer, a little one that's about 4¾ by 4¾ by 4¾ inches, and I'll have some time to play with it and get a sense of what's going on there.
Yeah, very good. You'll have fun. The one I was exposed to had, I guess it was about 1 foot square all the way around, and I saw demonstrations of how they made the Eiffel Tower and a couple of things, so naturally, in school I had to make me a little rocket. I mean, it's only about maybe 2.5 inches tall, but it's pretty cool. And it's amazing to watch this thing out. You could look through the glass and watch it work. That was pretty good. And they use that white. It's a white, very hard plastic. I mean, whatever it is, it's very solid. I mean, it's almost like an ABS plastic. Back to you, Roy.
Yes, ABS is one of the primary plastics that people are using for these 3D printers. There's another variety called PLA, which is a more organic compound that's biodegradable, and it doesn't smell quite as plasticky when it's being melted. This particular unit I got, I like particularly because it has a HEPA filter system, so that all the kind of fumes and chemicals can get absorbed in the activated carbon and such. So it's much more family friendly, if you know what I mean.
Very good. And then there's different various programs you can buy for that, or I guess you probably even download them for free. But that's what they had. They had different choices of different things that you could make, and you just plug that picture in, or you could actually design your own picture, and it will do it. It's amazing.
Yeah, within given restraints, if you can imagine it, if you can design it on a 3D piece of programming, you can build it.
And the real fancy ones, the rocket companies are using, they're building these parts of engines, large quantities of engines are being produced with the 3D. You've got a lot of companies, SpaceX and Rocket Lab, they're doing it, and Strato Launch, they're building a new rocket. Everybody's jumping on the 3D bandwagon, so of course that's not plastic, but a lot of rockets that are flying are built with 3D machines. It's incredible.
Yes, they're probably using more of the sintered metal powder technology rather than the general thermoplastics. It's a great technology. It's like anything. It's a tool. It's very good for one-of-a-kind, two-of-a-kind products. If you're planning to mass-produce something, it's not terribly cost-effective. It's far cheaper to design a mold and then just do standard injection molding. But if it's a couple of items that you just need right now that you can't through the entire process of building a mold and getting an injection system going, then it's an incredibly useful thing. Industry uses it all the time, I understand.
Yeah, they do. And anytime I'm reading through anything, if I see the word additive manufacturing, you know, that's what it is. That's 3D. You know, sometimes you read these articles and you see additive manufacturing, you don't see the word 3D throughout the whole article, but that will be the article I'll read about. I'll let you continue on, Roy. AC2GSWS2S.
Okay, thank you very much, Paul. If anyone else has any comments or questions about this particular story or 3D printing in general, feel free. Okay, to the next. Well, I find that, that many people have their own pet theories, something that neither is proven nor disproven. Grant money hasn't yet been applied to study it very well. For me, I have frequently pondered why. One sec, let me just take a look at something. Okay, getting back. For me, I frequently pondered why allergies seem so much more prevalent and deadlier than they seemed to be when I was younger. I mean, my gut feeling is that it might be due to an almost phobic mania we seem to have to keep young children's environment as sterile as humanly possible. I tend to think that we have evolved to make fine-tuned adjustments to our immune system based on our frequent exposure to environmental agents such as the dust and dirt and soil and all that stuff that you want to keep far away from dear Johnny while he's young and innocent and hasn't established a full set of immune responses yet. Now, I may be absolutely wrong, but all I have is some causality and some reasonable possible explanation. But that isn't enough for a scientific theory. Now, according to a new research conducted by scientists from Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit recently, this theory might not be that far-fetched after all. The researchers interviewed 128 mothers of infants multiple times over a period of 15 months and asked how they cleaned their child's pacifier. Of the 58% of mothers whose children used soothers, 41% said they cleaned them via sterilization, something akin to boiling the pacifier in water. 72% said that they washed them by hand, and 12% of mothers said they cleaned their infant's pacifier by sucking on them themselves. The researchers knew that exposure to certain microorganisms early in life stimulates the development of immune system and may protect against allergic diseases later. The researchers found that children of the soother-sucker mothers had lower levels of an antibody called immunoglobulin E, or called IgE. This antibody is related to allergic responses in the body. With some exceptions, higher levels of IgE indicate a higher level of having allergy.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The associated decrease in IgE levels and thus the protective effect against allergies start around 10 months, and the effect continues to about 18 months. More research is needed to understand what's going on here, but the researchers suspect that mothers are transferring health-promoting microbes to their children. The researchers would also like to know if lower IgE production seen in these children continues into their later years. That cleaning soother by sucking on them could help to prevent allergies isn't totally shocking. Research published in 2016 showed that Amish children are less susceptible to allergies, a likely consequence of their exposure to a wide variety of microbes. Similarly, kids who bite their nails and suck their thumbs fewer allergies. These findings add further credence to the hygiene hypothesis that I have as well, the idea that increasing rates of autoimmune and allergic diseases seen around the world are related to society's relatively newfound obsession with cleanliness. Some dirt and grime, so to speak, might actually be good for our kids. Let me drop for a second. Researchers know that exposure to certain microorganisms early in life stimulate development of the immune system and may protect against allergic disease later. Parental pacifier sucking may be an example of the way parents may transfer healthy microorganisms to their young children. Importantly, the new study points to an association between parents who suck on their child's pacifier and children with lower IgE levels. But that doesn't prove that pacifier sucking causes lower IgE. Correlation, as we know, doesn't always imply causation. Another thing to remember is that this research was based on the self-reporting of parents. According to the new research, a mere 12% of mothers said that they used the sucking technique to clean pacifiers. The real figure could be higher than this if some mothers did not want to admit the practice. It could also be lower. Regardless, this certainly could be affecting the results. Let me drop for a second. And lastly, this research does not speak to the risks associated with cleaning dirty, potentially germ-ridden soothers by sucking on them. Picking up a soother from the floor of a shopping mall or an airport and then cleaning it by sucking on it could be putting both parent and child at risk of contracting some communicable disease. But this new study, while offering some important new insight into factors that influence a child's allergic response, should not necessarily be taken as an endorsement of this practice. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Has there been a study with peanuts? You know, I've seen so many people that I know or other people that know other people that have kids that are affected by peanuts or peanut butter. And when I was a kid, you know, in the 50s, early 60s, I never heard of it. I've never heard of anybody going through it. In fact, I used to go to the classes and they had, if you forgot your lunch, they would have spare peanut butter sandwiches, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for people. So I wonder if that could be the problem, too. You know, if they're keeping them away from it for years when they're born, thinking, well, maybe they have an allergic reaction to peanut butter. Maybe if they did do that, they would have built up an immunity to that product. What do you think? Back to you, Roy.
Well, Paul, I mean, that is certainly a possibility. It wasn't really looked into in this particular study, because it's rather specific. I don't know exactly what's going on with the peanut allergies. I don't really get the sense that the young mothers are anxious about not exposing their children to peanuts as a just-in-case type of situation. I think just accidentally they discover after they've been in the peanuts that they have an allergic response. And the nature of allergies is you can't actually be allergic to something that your immune system has never dealt before. You kind of build up allergies to things. So when you're exposed to some noxious agent, your immune system kind of decides, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. And unfortunately, if it decides that it's bad, it remembers that. And the next time it comes into contact, it really acts up. And I think that's the problem with our immune system. Since a lot of children are kept scrupulously sterile and clean, they're not given the chance to introduce their immune system to non-dangerous other things in their environment that they now overreact to and develop all kinds of peanut allergies and gluten allergies and this, that, and the other allergies. It's just that young people are a heck of a lot more allergic these days than they ever were when I was and you were a kid.
C2IS, come in.
Yes, AC2IS.
You just said something about the immune system maybe not being exposed to quote-unquote non-threats. I think maybe the problem is the immune system is not exposed to moderate actual threats. And with the immune system not being exposed to threats in general, it's kind of designed to find threats somewhere. So all of a sudden the threshold for what constitutes a threat drops down, then all of a sudden peanuts qualify, and then you get an immune system overreaction. That's my guess. Anyway, I just thought I'd mention that. AC2IS.
No, it sounds totally logical and very reasonable and just as likely to be what's going on. There's a whole bunch of non-hard... heart-written kind of code that we manifest, that we develop as infants and early childhood, that we don't really appreciate. We know that we learn languages, but there's a lot of other things that don't seem that obvious that we learn. And I think one of the things we learn is what is out there immunologically and what the right setting for things might be. And since the present generation of parents is scrupulously keeping their child away from any noxious agent, our immune system is miscalibrating itself. At least that's my conclusion, again, based more on causation than on absolute proof. But it sounds reasonable to me, personally.
Comment. This is KC2, SHO. Recently I heard an interview with an author who wrote a book called Never Home Alone. And they've done more studies on the, I don't know what you want to call it, the microcosm of your home compared to outside and how we've isolated.
AC2IS, you dropped out. I don't know, perhaps there's something wrong either with the radio or the connection.
Oh, my handheld went dead. KC2SHO, I'm back on the base here.
Okay, please continue.
Yeah, how much of what I said did you catch? Should I start over?
Yeah, probably that would be the best, because you dropped out after 15 seconds of it.
My apologies. Was not paying attention to the battery indicator there. Yeah, recently, the short of it is there's a guy who wrote a book called Never Home Alone. There's a really good interview on, I think it was Fresh Air, Terry Gross on NPR. Very good interview, a lot of information in the interview, and I'm sure the book is quite good as well, although I haven't read any of that. It all sounds very fascinating and very pertinent to the discussion here tonight. EC2GS, KC2SHO.
Well, that's a very strange courtesy tone. I think that this is going to get a lot more research directed towards it, because it's becoming a terrible emergency. There are so many young people with so many awful allergic responses, and I'm sure people have heard in the news the EpiPen, which is kind of an emergency measure for anaphylactic shock and such. It went up in price a ridiculous amount of money. So hopefully there'll be a lot more research directed towards this end of whether there are beneficial organisms that mediate the immune response or whether you have to train the immune response early. The more information we learn always is better.
Yeah, his closing statement at the end of the at the end of the interview was basically him saying, "I hope that someday we can almost treat the this microcosm around us, if that's even the right term, more like a gardening than just a complete sanitization to promote the good things and keep away the bad things. We've actually gone a little too far in the sanitization area that, I'm sure you've talked about it before, the beneficial bacteria getting killed off, you know, with all of the troublesome bacteria. I've been hearing for years, I used to work with a guy with a peanut allergy, and now I have a son with a peanut allergy. Although we're not super about, sanitizing everything. But that they started to use a very minute trace of peanuts as a therapy. So people who have these allergies, they'll slowly give them a very tiny bit over time to help build their immunity again. IEC2, GFKC2, SHO.
Peter's acting very weird lately. Anyway, yeah, that's a very, very well-used principle. That's the underlying reason why people go and get allergy shots, that if you give small amounts of a material you're allergic to, you'll slowly deaden the immune response for any other external exposure. So hopefully that'll help. But there's probably going to be much more sophisticated methods of modulating immune responses down the line. Medical science is working on all those ends, and hopefully they'll come up with something and fix a lot of things. It's dangerous for children these days, and much more than it was, at least in my recollection, in my time. Yes, Rich.
As you stated that this medication was went way up in price, I think it's disgusting. It makes me think of the pharmaceutical industry and a bunch of drug pushers.
Well, I don't want to disparage an entire industry, and pharmaceuticals are very important in the field of medicine, which is why it's called medicine. I was just kind of confused when I had a patient who was really annoyed with me prescribing medicine, and I would tend to point to the doctorate that I have and say it's a degree in medicine. If you want something other than medicine, although we don't just push medicine, we push lifestyle and a whole bunch of other things. So medicine is a necessary evil. So we used to have some amateurs on this repeater who thought that it was all just a big scam and they didn't take their pills and we don't hear from them anymore. So medicines are okay. There are businessmen who run pharmaceutical companies who are greedy bastards, unfortunately. And that's why there should be some degree of regulation and why people can't simply multiply the price of a given product by 5 or 10 or 20 and just stand there and say, what are you going to do about it?
Oh, I understand fully, Roy. People need certain medicines. But I don't believe that drug companies raise the prices up so high because they need it. And I feel sorry for people who don't have insurance. What are they going to do? And while I agree with you, there should be government regulation.
Yeah, Rich, I mean, like anything, there has to be some kind of compromise, happy medium. Pharmaceutical companies make the point that in order for new medications to become available, they need a lot of money to spend looking for the stuff, testing the stuff, approving the stuff, and getting the stuff out. So if you cut them off by the knees, yes, you're stopping new development of pharmaceutical agents. But I cannot stop thinking that maybe they have kind of joined the gravy train of a lot of businesses lately where you squeeze the last bit of a dollar out of the customer. So there's got to be a happy medium that requires, unfortunately, government regulation, because that's the only method I can think of, and that veers very, very closely to politics, which I don't want to get into. Perhaps it can be discussed on the political net that will start at around 12:05 this morning on the repeater.
Yes, not to get into political, we'll drop the subject. But I agree, the charge, I know they need a lot of money for research, but I think there has to be some regulation. Like I said, well, what do poor people do who don't have insurance? Fortunately, it's covered by insurance. What if it wasn't?
I absolutely positively agree with you, Rich. It's very serious. Medication can make or break a person's health. You know, without it, there's so many problems that simply can't be treated, and it's necessary. And there are terrible cases of very esoteric diseases where the return on investment is so low that the pharmaceutical companies have kicked up the price per dose to thousands of dollars. And if you can't pay it, and a lot of insurance companies balk at it, some don't, but some do, then you're in deep trouble. Unfortunately, at this point in time, we don't have a right to good health. That's not one of the things that seem to be covered. But hopefully, we'll kind of do better by ourselves and treat each other much better than we have lately.
But why, I'll tell you a quick story. There used to be, there was something up on the Senate and the House. It was called the Orphan Drug Bill. Reagan was going to veto it, but fortunately, I had previously sent a letter to Senator Barry Goldwater. He's a ham. He died. K7UGA. I looked him up in the call book. Anyways, I sent him a nice letter with a QSL card, and I told him it should be the importance of this bill. You know, I heard on the radio months later that just before Reagan was going to do it, they put one of his old-time friends, Barry Goldwater, told him it was good registration. I can't help but thinking it was my letter.
Well, that would be very nice, Rick. And perhaps it was, or perhaps Barry Goldwater, who unfortunately, and again, was very close to the business of the political net after 12:05, he got a bad rep back in the 1960s as a kind of hard-hearted, as ultra-conservative. But you know, when he finally passed away, everyone gave him the title statesman. He was a ham, and he was a decent human being, which probably is about the same. Good ham tends to be a decent human being.
Absolutely, boy. I know there were many political articles, many political ads by LBJ. You could see them on the internet. Interesting. My father voted for LBJ. Many years later, he was sorry he voted for Senator Goldwater as president.
Yes, Rich, the most famous ad I recall of that campaign was the Daisy ad, where there's a little child who kind of plucks a daisy and pulls its petals, loves me not, and then they kind of superimpose a nuclear mushroom, which was not a commercial, but I guess it was effective at the time.
Yes, that's the one I'm referring to. That was the Cold War and Vietnam. They scared people.
Well, fear tends to be a good motivator, unfortunately. It's sort of like the dark side of the force, but it is effective.
Yes, it is, boy. All right, let's not believe it. But I liked him as a ham. I was very sorry that he didn't get it. I'll stand by. That's who we are.
Okay, unless anyone else has any questions or comments on the subject, I'll move on to the next topic. Okay, another thing that bothered me are the incredible health claims provided by those manufacturers of those standing desks. Now, you've probably seen these advertisements for these things. They're usually built with either elongated legs or they have cranks so that you can heighten the elevation to allow your desk work. You can stand while you're doing your desk work. Now, there's so many claims of improved health and energy that I always tended to note the vague scent of snake oil being sold on those commercials. Now, we know that physical activity is good for us and that being sedentary is not. Some have extrapolated this to mean that sitting in general is something to be avoided, even at work. Perhaps as a result, standing desks have become trendy and are promoted by some health officials as well as some countries. Now, research, however, suggests that warnings about sitting at work are overblown and that standing desks are overrated as a way to improve your health. David Rampell, a professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, has written on this issue and said, well-meaning safety professionals and some office furniture manufacturers are pushing sit-stand workstations as a way of improving cardiovascular health, and there's no scientific evidence to support this recommendation, end quote. For convenience and comfort, it's nice to have options if you have various aches and pains. Alternately, standing and sitting while using a computer could be for some people with lower back or neck pain, but people shouldn't be under the illusion that they're getting exercise. Let's start with what we know about research on sitting, then explain why it can be misleading as it relates to work. A number of studies have found a significant association between prolonged sitting over a 24-hour period and increased risk for cardiovascular disease. Let me drop for a second.
Repeater, timeout.
Ran over. Anyway, a 2015 study, for instance, followed more than 150,000 older adults, all of whom were healthy at the start of the study, for almost 7 years on average. Researchers found that those who sat at least 12 hours a day had significantly higher mortality than those who sat less than 5 hours per day. Now, a 2012 study in the Journal of American Medical Association's Internal Medicine followed more than 220,000 people for 2.8 years on average and found similar results. Prolonged sitting over the course of a day was associated with an increased all-cause mortality across sexes, age, body mass index. So, did a smaller but longer study published in 2015 in the Journal of Physical Activity and Health. Another study from 2015, which followed more than 50,000 adults for more than 3 years, also found this relationship, but it found that context mattered. Prolonged sitting in certain situations, include when people were at work, did not have the same effect. Let me drop for a second. Why might that be, you ask? Well, sitting itself may not be the problem. It may be a marker for other risk factors that would be associated with higher mortality. Unemployed or poorer people, who would also be more likely to have higher mortality, may be more likely to spend large amounts of time sitting at home. For some, sedentary time is a marker, not the cause of bad outcomes. Studies looking specifically at work, don't find a causal pattern. On a 2015 paper focused on workers aged 50 to 74 in Japan, more than 10 years on average per participant, it found that among salaried workers, professionals, and those in home businesses, there was no association between sitting at work and cardiovascular risk. A 2016 study examined Danish workers also failed to find a link. Let me drop for a second. A systemic review published in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine found that there were many studies that identified applications with sitting at work and poor health outcomes. But when they focused on prospective studies following groups of people forward over time, which might better confirm a causal link, they found that there wasn't really much evidence to support it. Moreover, these